This episode of Observer Radio was recorded on Thursday, October 9th. For updates on the stories discussed in this episode, visit texasobserver.org. TexasObserver.org, you're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. Each week, our half-hour program features writers from the Texas Observer and other esteemed guests for a conversation about the biggest issues in Texas politics and culture. Joining us by phone this week is staff writer Emily DePrang. Welcome, Emily.
Thank you.
Also with us is RH Reality Check senior political reporter and Observer columnist Andrea Grimes. Welcome, Andrea.
Howdy.
Later in the show, we'll discuss the current state of Texas's omnibus anti-abortion bill, better known as HB 2. Last week, the Fifth Circuit Court ruled that all portions of HB 2 can go into effect immediately. Today, we have still more news, and we will get to that in the second half of the show. First, we have a story that, well, frankly, put me through a bit of an emotional roller coaster as I read it. The story is To Catch a Rapist, currently published on TexasObserver.org and in our October issue under the headline Tested. In this story, Emily DePrang explains that Texas cops have left nearly 20,000 rape kits untested. Now, a few agencies are confronting that injustice, and Houston Police Department is leading the way. Emily, let's start by talking about what happens when a person completes a sexual assault evidence collection kit. So that everyone understands the courage it requires for a sexual assault victim to go through the process.
Sure. So after someone has been assaulted, they would go to, if they choose, they would go to a hospital. And the hospital would complete a sexual assault evidence collection kit. So that's going to contain swabs from the inside of their mouth, from their genitals, their anus, their scrapings from under their fingernails. It's going to contain combings of their hair or their body hair to try to look for foreign DNA. It's very, intrusive is not, not even the word. That sounds like something that it's allowing a stranger to contact you physically, exposing yourself physically in exactly the place, specifically the places that you have just been violated. So it is a really intense thing to undertake, and it's not brief, and it's done with the understanding that it's worth it because it's going to be tested and it's going to help convict whoever did this terrible thing to you.
Right. As I mentioned in the intro, we're talking about 20,000 untested rape kits here. Kind of a big question, but how does a police department wind up with a backlog of rape kits?
Well, first, I just want to specify that 20,000 number that's the number that we cite because that's what we know. What we know of is that there are more than 19,000 rape kits that went untested in Texas that are just lying around in police departments and in crime labs, but mostly in police departments in Texas, or have been. But the way that we know that is that in 2011, Wendy Davis passed a bill requiring law enforcement agencies to count their untested kits and report that. And as of August, which is when I was able to get my information, only 146 agencies in Texas had reported, and that's how we came up with that 20,000 number.
And that's 146 out of how many agencies?
146 agencies out of 2,647.
Mm-hmm.
So that 146 includes a lot of the larger cities. So you're going to get a lot of the larger numbers already, but that we shouldn't look at that 20,000 number as being like how many there are. That's how many were reported from just 146 agencies that have fulfilled this requirement. So that's where that number comes from. Just FYI. I mean, it's speculation, obviously, but it's it's probably very safe speculation to say that the number is much, much higher.
Why haven't the other agencies responded?
Because they don't really have to. It's hard enough to pass a law forcing law enforcement agencies to do anything. Law enforcement it's just a very powerful lobby, and this was the counting process, the largely, unfunded mandate that required agencies to do this count. It was hard enough for them to get it passed just saying, you really ought to do this, or you lawfully, you have to do this. They couldn't pass it with any kind of teeth because they couldn't say, you'll lose this funding or whatever if you don't do it, because you can't really require them to do something that's going to take resources unless you offer money to help them do the thing. Obviously, I'm not talking about, small towns that ought to be able to go into one room and go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay, we have 6. They don't really have an excuse. But Basically, there's no teeth in the bill because it would have been impossible to pass with teeth. And so then you're stuck in this kind of limbo where, it's lawfully required, but there's nothing to actually make law enforcement agencies comply.
Is part of the problem that there was no additional funding or not enough additional funding?
Yeah. So another part of the Davis bill was that agencies, they had to count and report, and then they had to also get all of their old kits tested. And so in 2011, they didn't manage to pass it. When a bill passed, they didn't pass it with any funding. But in the next session, they added $11 million that they allocated for getting that done. The problem is that sexual assault kits cost $900 to $1,000 each to test.
Right.
And so, you don't have to be a math major to tell that's not going to go that far, besides which, the bill also requires that police agencies submit all of their tests from now on to a crime lab within 30 days. But the state money, and the state is actually working to add more money to that now, but even state and federal money is not currently really covering what that's going to cost. So there are some enforcement problems that kind of go back to the old Texas, the basic Texas problem, which is, what are your priorities? There's a whole lot of money to go around, but there's a whole lot of places that need it. And is it important or not? And prioritizing based on resources is how you ended up with, 20,000 plus untested rape kits, because when people talk about rape kits and they talk about backlogs, and it's a useful term because it's easier than saying cache of untested rape kits or whatever,
right.
it's the backlog, but it's not really a backlog. Through the early aughts, there was definitely, and still is to a certain extent, a problem with police departments requesting DNA evidence for both sexual assaults and lots of other crimes, including property crimes. There's a big growth in them requesting DNA for that, but requesting those things and labs not having the capacity. So labs would say, you can request this, but we're not going to get around to it for 6 months. So then agencies would stop asking. They prioritize, the cases basically. To put it bluntly, they prioritize the cases that they care about. It's the cases where they really, and what that means is that prejudices and misconceptions and just outdated and terrible attitudes and wrong attitudes about sexual assault are allowed to impact justice. So, the Houston Police Department, when they decided to tackle their 6,600, untested kits, which, to their credit, they chose to do before Davis's bill. When they decided to do that, they applied for a grant to do an interdisciplinary study to figure out how they got there, how they ended up with so many kits. And the answer is really that when they didn't believe a victim, they didn't believe it was really rape. They thought she was just trying to get out of something. Consent was an issue, or she if she knew who it was.
Right.
And he said, well, this is consensual, and she said it wasn't. They'd be like, eh, it's he said, she said, we're not going to test the kid.
Yeah, there's a there's a line in your piece I feel like I should bring up here. It goes as follows. Many times officers shelved the evidence and blamed, disbelieved, or otherwise alienated victims, then closed their cases.
Yes, that was one of the things that this inquiry found, was that, you know, if officers weren't very interested in the case, either they, you know, for a variety of reasons, some of them race and socioeconomic status, if they didn't believe the victim or they didn't value, I mean, just to put it frankly, they didn't value the victim, didn't find it a particularly sympathetic or compelling case, they would, you know, interview the victim, and then that might be all they did. And they say, well, you know, I don't really. And then if they take the initial report, and then if they were not required to go out and try to talk to somebody, they would make a couple phone calls, and they'd say, oh, well, she didn't call me back, so we're closing the case. Or they would send a letter through the mail that says, come in and participate with your investigation. And if they didn't get a response, they close the case.
Right.
So, you know, that's just, that's kind of like a way that they handled their caseloads. And that's not something like that I'm, as an outsider, coming in and saying, like, accusing them of doing. That's something that their researchers found to be true.
Okay, well, we've got a few minutes left. Let's talk about HPD and how they are sort of changing things. What are they doing, practically speaking, and what does that look like?
Well, one of the things that they did, besides choosing to have all of their kids tested, and also they chose to do that before it was required. Obviously, now it's required, but lots of places aren't, you know, hustling to do it. But they also made a commitment to investigating those all fully, which is a big deal, because there have been other police agencies around the country that, you know, after there was a big scandal about untested kids, you know, they would get they would say, fine, we'll test it.
Right.
But they didn't make the commitment to investing the resources to actually hunt down the rapists that they identified. So that it didn't make like a big difference. And the other thing is, you know, if you don't change your policies, then you're going to have the same issues. So one of the big things they did is they brought in a justice advocate, which is basically a social worker who now sits in the room, you know, in the bullpen with the sexual assault investigators. And she is this just bubbly young woman who has a, you know, a master's in social work and can inform them about trauma, can meet with victims with them. And because she's a classified employee, she's an employee of HPD, you know, she has access to case files and things, and she helps investigators understand victims and helps victims feel safe talking to investigators, and just really improves the experience of people who do go to the police. So that's a big deal. Both of those things are a big deal.
Is there any indication that other police departments around the state may follow suit?
Well, police departments aren't known for putting out a press release saying, you're right, we're wrong, we'll get on that. But what we've heard from, what I've heard from national leaders on this issue, is that in places like Houston and Detroit that take it on themselves to do these sort of really comprehensive internal looks at their problem, are really the most vocal and effective advocates for change, because, you know, police departments expect, you know, nonprofits to, quote unquote, have an agenda. I mean, obviously that's their job, and to push and to say, you should do this and you should do that. But hearing it from other police agencies, law enforcement agencies, is really very effective.
The story, as we mentioned at the top, is called Tested. If you're reading it in the October issue of the Texas Observer, and To Catch a Rapist, if you're reading it on texasobserver.org. Emily, thanks so much for sharing this story with us.
Thank you.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show from the folks at the Texas Observer. Last week, the Fifth Circuit Court ruled that all portions of Texas's omnibus anti-abortion bill HB 2 can go into effect immediately. Today, we have even more news. And to help us make sense of everything, we're joined by RH Reality Check senior political reporter and Observer columnist Andrea Grimes. Andrea?
Hello.
How are you doing?
I am neck deep in court documents.
I bet. So, you know, the last time we had you on the show, things were looking slightly better for the pro-choice movement. Let's start by getting everyone up to speed. Where were we at the end of last week?
At the end of last week, things had taken a turn for the worst on the Texas abortion care landscape. On Thursday evening, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the state of Texas could begin enforcing HB 2, the omnibus anti-abortion law, in full. So all four tenets of the law, the medication abortion provision, the 20-week ban, the admitting privileges, and the ambulatory surgical center requirement, were in place all at once for the first time since the law was officially signed by Rick Perry. So on Friday morning when we woke up, we went from having 20 or so legal abortion facilities in Texas to 8. And those abortion facilities are located in Dallas-Fort Worth, Houston, Austin, in San Antonio. So there are no legal abortion facilities operating south or west of San Antonio as of last Friday.
So if you, say, live in Brownsville, how far would you have to travel?
A little over 500 miles round trip.
What sort of public reactions have you seen in response to the decision last Friday?
There has been outrage from folks in the reproductive justice movement and smug backpatting from the anti-choice movement. In Austin, here we had a rally on Friday, and we joined up at the Capitol steps and had kind of a feels moment. Had some talking, some poetry, mm-hmm. some yelling, some screaming. since then. A lot has happened even since Friday and Saturday. It's like we can never just stop and sit with the decisions that courts have made. There's always something more coming down the pipeline.
Okay, and that, I think, leads us very nicely into what happened today. What did the Fifth Circuit decide today?
The Fifth Circuit today said that it would not rehear part of an earlier challenge to HB 2. So this is where it gets kind of mucky. There are two federal court challenges to HB 2, one of which was filed in the fall of 2013 and one of which was filed in the spring of 2014.
Okay.
The challenge that was filed in the fall of 2013 challenges the medication abortion part of HB 2, and it challenges the admitting privileges part of HB 2. The Fifth Circuit ruled earlier this year on that and said, no, we totally love HB 2 in all of these ways. It's really fantastic. Y'all go ahead and state of Texas just totally enforce this stuff. So the recourse that abortion providers had at that point was to go back to the Fifth Circuit and say, hey, instead of the 3-judge panel that said HB 2 is awesome, can we get the whole court to listen to our arguments about HB 2? It's kind of like, if your dad says you can't go to the zoo, like, you might be like, hey, but what if you talk to mom and see if mom says maybe I should go to the zoo?
Right.
Like, you know, it's kind of a second appeal. And so that has been ongoing for many, many months. And we just found out today that the Fifth Circuit voted not to rehear that particular part of the federal case, which means at this point that the only recourse abortion providers have there is to go to appeal to the Supreme Court. And it's worth noting, I think, because a lot of people may not know this, the Fifth Circuit Court and all circuit courts are political appointees. The judges on those courts are political appointees. So in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, I believe we have 5 Democratic appointees and 10 Republican appointees. Mm-hmm. And in this case, 3 of the judges, all 3 of which were Democratic nominees, voted to say, yes, we would like to rehear this case. And 12 judges, including two Democratic nominees, appointees, said, no, we don't care about rehearing this case. We think the initial ruling was fine.
And did they provide any sort of reasoning?
The people, the judges, as if judges are people, that's crazy. The judges who voted not to rehear the case did not provide any reasoning. However, there was a really strongly worded dissent authored by Judge James Dennis, who did not mince words when he wrote that the Fifth Circuit should have heard the case again en banc. He called the earlier panel hearing, he basically said that it was a travesty of justice and that the Fifth Circuit rewrote legal precedent and disregarded good medical and scientific evidence, and that it was kind of causing irreparable harm to not rehear the case. Unfortunately, you know, he was one of three and going against 12 people that said, nah, we like our earlier ruling.
And what about on the other side? What kind of reactions have you seen today?
From what? So there's too many other sides.
Sorry, which other from, side? From the pro-choice movement.
They're dismayed. Narrow Pro-Choice Texas put out a statement saying that they're dismayed. You know, the Center for Reproductive Rights is ticked off. I don't think anybody was particularly surprised that the Fifth Circuit would decline to rehear the case. And I do think that the dissent that Judge Dennis wrote gave people a lot of it vindicated a lot of what people have been feeling. So that was kind of a nice thing to read. It was nice to hear a federal court judge agree with, you know, scientists and doctors,
right,
instead of just wholesale, you know, dismiss what they had to say. But I don't think the Fifth Circuit's decision today was a surprise to anybody.
Is there any hope?
I want the answer to that question to be yes.
And me too.
I think the answer to that question is no.
I'm sorry for asking. I shouldn't have.
Well, I think a lot hinges on Justice Kennedy in the Supreme Court. He's the swing vote between the conservative judges and the less conservative judges.
Right.
I think that people I think that there are perhaps efforts to persuade public opinion such that Kennedy might be inclined to rule in favor of abortion providers when this case gets to the Supreme Court. But I think at this point it really hinges on Kennedy.
And what does that cost the women of Texas? I mean, what, you know, the idea of these bills is that you'll stop abortion by stopping legal abortion. And it's like this unstated thing, but you know, that may not be true.
Right. Well, I mean, if you were to ask Jody Laubenberg or Glenn Hager, they would say the point of the bills is to increase the health and safety of women.
Do what now?
To increase the health and safety of women.
That's so weird.
But, I mean, obviously, as you say, like, you know, and I know, and everybody knows that the point of the law is to close abortion clinics. It's certainly not going to end abortion. It will end a lot of legal abortion. And it will put people in danger. I mean, that's what the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists issued an open letter to the Texas legislature saying this bill will kill people. It puts people in danger. It's a terrible idea. And the Texas legislature gleefully ignored it because you have to ignore medical evidence and science and mainstream logical opinions to be able to pass this kind of thing. So at this point, basically, the reproductive fate of people with uteri in Texas rests in the hands of 9 people on the Supreme Court.
Okay, so but what are the next steps? What are abortion providers likely to do next?
So the next steps logistically for abortion providers is that they try to stay open as long as possible. And I mean that literally, like for as many days of the week and for as many hours as possible to increase their capacity if they can. Mm-hmm. The existing Texas ambulatory surgical centers were doing about 14 or 15,000 abortions previous to HB2. We know that Texas on average has about 70,000 abortions per year.
Mm-hmm.
So these ambulatory surgical centers, between the seven or eight of them, are going to have to increase their capacity many fold. So that's something that they're going to have to work on immediately. And, you know, in the long run, legally speaking, there's the Fifth Circuit still has yet to hear this second challenge to HB2 on the merits of the case. Mm-hmm. So that will happen. And I think we can expect a not favorable to abortion providers ruling from that. And then it's going to go to the Supreme Court. So at this point, all roads lead to the Supreme Court, except for the roads in Texas that lead to Dallas, Fort Worth, Houston, Austin, or San Antonio, where there are abortion facilities.
You can read more of Andrea's reporting on this story by going to rhrealitycheck.org. Andrea, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for Observer Radio this week. But before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music. And of course, a big thanks to all of you out there listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Schultz. For more Texas news and culture, you can visit us on the web at texasobserver.org, or you can pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk at you again next time on Observer Radio.